So I'm really excited about Nick's program today as well. Like many Kentuckians, I do enjoy a glass of bourbon. But it's also fascinating for its history. And we have a lot of Kentucky stories to tell here at the Historical Society. Really talking about the social and the economic impact of the industry over time is really a fascinating thing for me, and I think it's a great opportunity for us as a historical society. And so Nick's work is really contributing to that base of knowledge, and I'm excited about what he's going to share with us. So let's welcome Nick Laraquinte.
Well, thank you very much. So I guess volume check first. Can everybody hear me all right? I'm kind of bad at talking into mics. So we can be as interactive as we want, or you guys can just sit back and munch and listen, and I'll rattle on. I can talk forever about bourbon and archaeology, but feel free to ask questions if you have any while we go. Also, we're going to be scratching the surface of a lot of different things that I'm into today, and there's going to be opportunities later on in the next few months to go to presentations that focus especially on Canada Dry Distillery, on farm distilleries, on Bourbon Pompeii, and I've posted some of those events on the Bourbon Archaeology Facebook page, so feel free to look at that, or you can ask about it later. So one of the first questions that I'm usually asked when I talk about the archaeology of distilleries, especially by bourbon fans, is like, all right, bourbon's booming right now. There's new distilleries opening all the time. There's Michael Veach's book, Fred Minnick's book, all these other awesome popular histories, as well as all the master distillers to talk to, right? So what is there left to learn about distilleries? Don't we know everything, or everything important anyway? And the easy answer is no, because there were thousands of distilleries throughout Kentucky's history, depending on how you define them. And the way that I approach them is looking at everything from moonshine sites to farm distilleries to the big industrial distilleries that still operate today, because they're all part of that same process, and they all intersect in Kentucky's history with different societal movements, temperance movements, religious movements. You could talk about technological innovations. You can do almost anything with a distillery as a base. And so I find it useful because as an archaeologist, as a preservationist, as a historian, sometimes we have trouble hooking the audience that we want to talk to, right? But bourbon fans are often accidental preservationists because they're very concerned with authenticity. And so they come for the bourbon and they stay for the archaeology and everything that comes with it afterward. So an example of that is just the process of slowing down and taking a closer look at sites that you might not look at twice otherwise. This is a bridge crossing the Kentucky River just south of Camp Nelson, if you've ever gone down below the highway bridge. And it's the location of the Canada Dry Distillery is what it was called in its last iteration. It was also very early on in its history, the Camp Nelson Distillery, and actually supplied troops with whiskey rations at one point. But I became familiar with this because when I started my research, one of my neighbors is actually the grandson of the last master distiller that worked here, Mel Hawkins, and his grandson, Sam. We'll talk about him more later. But I was showing him pictures of this, and eventually we actually got to go and tour the site, and there's lots of interesting ruins and stuff left of it. And that's kind of the first level of an archaeological investigation. You could stop, see the photos, maybe look at the things, and it's like, okay, that's interesting. But when you dig a little bit deeper, you spend a little bit more time on things, you start to unpack what's really important, and that's the stories or people's connections with the history, right? So when Sam was down here, he actually got all teary-eyed because he used to come down as a kid, and he said he was very excited because the whole valley smelled like yeast biscuits, kind of the same way this valley smells sometime because of Buffalo Trace, right? And he was very excited because it was one of his favorite things for breakfast, yeast biscuits, a little bit of country ham, and he was always disappointed because there was only whiskey here, and he just didn't understand, I guess, the value of it at that time. So those stories are some of the kind of fun offsets of this. And I also think that the bonds that we build with the community members, because my work is not just me. I've worked with a few hundred people now, and Thomas and Scott here in the audience have been out there actually excavating some of these artifacts with me. So it's a big team effort. So to get everyone on the same page, even though it feels kind of silly in a room full of Kentuckians, when we're talking about whiskey, let's talk about just the process so we get everybody on the same page. So pretty much all whiskey, no matter what you're talking about, has a few different common components. First of all, you got the water and the processed grain that's mixed together, and it ferments, right? So no heat's added at this stage. What's happening here is yeast is eating the sugars that's in those grains. It's off-putting alcohol until the alcohol gets to a concentration where it essentially kills itself. That's the point that you have distiller's beer. Then it goes into copper stills. They can look a variety of different things. When you get into moonshine, sometimes you get into things that aren't copper, and there's some harmful side effects to that. But for the most part, you have copper stills. So at this point, heat's added. Everything kind of bubbles up. And as the alcohol evaporates and goes up into, in this case, the column stills, it condenses into a clear liquid. You're looking at White Dog, New Make. If you're not paying your taxes, you call it moonshine at this point. And at this point, everything is extremely flammable, and there's often some disasters when you're looking at different distilleries over time, things like the river being set on fire and things like that. So then the whiskey's put into charred white oak barrels and placed in warehouses to age. Kentucky's hot summers and cool winters cause the whiskey to go in and out of that charred layer. It filters, it gets that color and all the yummy characteristics that we associate with bourbon. So bourbon is a specific type of whiskey. All bourbon is whiskey, but not all whiskey is bourbon. So when I'm talking about bourbon archaeology, if you wanted to get really technical about it, you say like whiskey archaeology, it just doesn't sound as fun. So just so we're accurate here. So if you look at Kentucky's history just over the course of time, the process of making whiskey stays pretty much the same throughout Kentucky's history. Its place in our society definitely doesn't. In the late 1700s, when Scotch Irish immigrants are settling in Kentucky, they bring in centuries of distilling knowledge, and they found Kentucky a very suitable place to make whiskey. Rye grows well, corn grows well, you got the limestone flavored water. But also, more importantly, Kentucky operates on a subsistence economy at this time. So whiskey is actually filling the role of currency, and you could distill a few gallons and trade it for help with things like barn raising and whatnot. So distilling's not a luxury. Before 1820s or so, that road system is very limited, and the cash crops are actually spoiling before they really get to market. So by using the corn and the rye to make whiskey, yes, you're making that currency that you can trade, but it's also one of the only ways you can get your grains to market without it rotting. So around the 1820s, there is a shift in the economy from bartering to actual cash economy. And this is where you start to see the rise in like scientific elements of the whiskey industry. Everything gets standardized. You get lots of brands happening. You also have the unfortunate side effect of now to this science, it's now a men's game, and women are more or less excluded from the industry whenever they were critical to it during the 1700s and early 1800s. But that's a presentation for a different time. So you start to see lots of branding where people are starting to say, all right, if I'm paying, I don't know, a few dollars for this gallon of whiskey, I want to know exactly what it tastes like. And then you also see a lot of industrial distilleries start really ramping up. Things like Old Crow Distillery and some of the others are really taking off. You see places like Tyrone near present-day Wild Turkey is founded just really to support a concentration of distilleries around it. So despite that critical nature of the industry to Kentucky, the industry was and continues to be entangled in many different political, religious movements. Throughout the 1800s, excise taxes were used to pay for wars, and they resulted in many different distilleries kind of shuttering because they can't afford to pay that tax up front, or they turned to moonshine, depending on what's happening at the time. You also see the industry blamed for a lot of violence, lots of different social ailments. You actually have, there's a collection of letters from Thomas Jefferson to different people he's working with on how whiskey is associated with a lot of lower class problems. And so he reasons that if you raise taxes on whiskey and lower taxes on wine, that that would magically solve people's problems for some reason. And then, of course, you have Prohibition is the big one, but you see elements of this throughout the 1800s. It shutters distilleries. Only a few can still make medicinal alcohol or military-grade alcohol, depending on the time. And in some distilling centers, the entire county becomes unemployed literally overnight. There's some excellent oral histories that are on file here in this building that talk about Nelson County. Prohibition passes, suddenly people that are good people are forced to turn to moonshine because of an overbearing government. And there's interesting differences in rhetoric whenever it suddenly impacts these kind of law-abiding people, because most of the time early on, especially in the 1800s and then currently today, moonshiners are often referred to in the same type of terms that you would hear like meth addicts describe, something like that. So there's interesting things to unpack there, but I haven't had time to do that yet. Eventually. So looking at this very broadly, if you look at the popular whiskey histories, Michael Veatch's book, Fred Minnick's, Carla's, any of these that you can really just pick up at the bookstore down the street, you start to see distilleries unpacked into three different tiers. You have the industrial distilleries whose main purpose is to produce as much whiskey as possible and to sell it. Those go out into global markets very easily. That's where you see the branding and all of that. So that's things like Wild Turkey, Buffalo Trace, basically any distillery that's on the Urban Trail or operating in Kentucky today is more or less at the level of an industrial distillery, even the things that qualify as craft in today's age. Farm distilleries are described by Michael Veatch as basically being 1 or 200 gallon stills. And if you look at his book, Whiskey and American Heritage, it gets maybe a few pages on it, and that's about it at the moment. Most of the time, these histories focus on the successful brands, the big names, the bourbon barons, things like that. Moonshine distills are basically blanket everything. It's illegal, and it's just referred to as moonshine, even though there's considerable variability within the moonshine industry as well. So what is the driving force behind this? It doesn't just happen. It's just like, all right, there's three different tiers. In the 1800s, basically everybody's starting with something that approximates a farm distillery, and it's those actions that the government takes in order to bring that wealth production under control that results in these tiers. So when taxes are implemented and you have to pay that tax up front before you can even bottle and sell your whiskey, suddenly only the wealthy are really able to have a distillery. Or you have some farmers that kind of hold on, they consolidate their grains, whatever, and they manage to hold on until basically the late 1800s. At that time, just before Prohibition, really the only thing that exists is either moonshine distilleries or industrial. So these are both distilleries. The one on the left is the old Grandad plant here in Frankfort, and the one on the right is the Epler Distillery in Woodford County. One of them has a big sign that says distillery on it and things that are easily identifiable, and this one's a pile of rocks. So the first question is like, all right, how do we really start to unpack what is a distillery and what isn't? And this problem was further illustrated because we thought, well, maybe we can just go and ask people, and people will be like, oh, well, that place has always been a distillery. So this is Mel Hawkins again from Canada Dry, and his grandson Sam, he decided he was going to help. Mel had described where a bunch of different farm distilleries were, and Sam liked taking his Rolls Royce out for spins on Sundays, so we just decided we were going to drive down a holler near Four Roses and just ask a bunch of people. So if anybody has to do like oral histories, historical surveys, whatever, this is a great icebreaker. You just pull up in the Rolls Royce and people will talk to you. So that day, literally everybody was just like, yes, I know there's a distillery, that pile of rocks near the water. Some things that were obviously outhouses were distilleries in these people's minds. So it was like the reality, the myth of the distillery industry was bigger than kind of the reality. So it's like, all right, it still doesn't get get at that question. It's like an outhouse is easily identifiable, but how do you tell the difference between a historic house site and, say, a still site? So I started digging into what's been done archaeologically so far by my predecessors, and surprisingly, there's very little. For some reason, there's a break between academic archaeologists and people interested in distilling alcohol as something for, like, after the conference instead of your serious research. But fortunately, George Washington's distillery at Mount Vernon was excavated at one point in the past, and they started publishing on it in 2004. And there's lots and lots of archival evidence, diaries, things like that, to describe what they're up to. But there was also a nice sign that said George Washington's distillery was here. What they did was they looked at all the different elements that go into making whiskey, and they broke it down into what they called feature systems. So you have your distilling, you have your mashing. All of those things have a certain set of materials that go along with it. So if you find something like a broken copper still, you know that you're working on a distilling site. Or if you're working near there and you're just finding like a bunch of buttons and clothing items and things like that, maybe you're working where the workers lived at. Things like that. So to put it into practice, this is Buffalo Trace here at the top, and at the bottom is Epler Distillery, just so you guys can get a sense of the size difference. This is actually double the scale of Buffalo Trace, so that site would basically fit in one of the parking lots. It's very small, even though they're doing the same things. So the mashing and fermenting systems are here on the two sites. Distillation is nearby at Buffalo Trace, so it doesn't have to travel that far. Things are connected by pipes and whatnot. But at the Epler Distillery, they had to take their processed grain, put it in a wagon, take it up to the top of the hill, and dump it in the top of the actual still area. So they had to travel in a very different way, and it means the site's laid out a little bit differently. Then at Buffalo Trace, you have storage across the whole site, while at Epler, they're just putting things in stoneware jugs and taking it out to the river. They don't really have a warehouse component at that time. Farm distilleries in general, you're not going to see aging in barrels, because when you put something in a barrel, you lose something like 30% of your volume like that. And farm distillers just couldn't afford that loss. Then you have bottling. Distribution, where you take those bottles and load them into the big rigs or whatever. In Epler's case, you're taking them a half mile down the creek to the Kentucky River and loading them onto a boat. And then you have administrative offices, maintenance warehouses, things like that, just kind of scattered all over these places. There's other systems like households that don't show up in the Buffalo Trace example, but the residence at Epler, where two brothers and their sister lived at, was just a few feet, and there's like a paved rock path that goes out to the actual still site. So to start looking a little bit closer at some of these, we'll concentrate right here at the OFC building that's affectionately known as Bourbon Pompeii. And you guys can get tours if you haven't been out there, 2:30 and basically any day of the week. Or you just ask me. I like going down there a lot. So this thing is, I still think of it as a once-in-a-lifetime occurrence, because, with industrial sites, you have a lot of reworking. Like, you think about all of the warehouses and stuff that you see at Buffalo Trace. That requires a lot of clearing the earth, and for archaeological purposes, that means you're actually bulldozing away all the artifacts and the things that could unpack those pieces of the past for us, right? So I never really expected to see something this interesting on an industrial site just because of the nature of it being reworked. But one of the good things for archaeology is disasters. And at one point, this building got struck by lightning and burnt down. They had to rebuild in a hurry. And that's one of the reasons that everything was preserved so well. So Buffalo Trace called me one day, and they're just like, "We found something old." And I get that kind of call a lot, so I ignored it. And then a week later, they actually called back, and they're like, "No, seriously, get out here. We found something old, and you need to see it." And the building was, it more or less looked like what you see there with the Bobcat, except that we hadn't started excavating the fermenting vats yet. And there's lots of 8-foot-deep holes, lots of layer of soil, things like that. And I was excited about it, but I didn't really know what it was. So they gave me a weekend, because at that time, they still had to stick to a very tight construction schedule, and they have no idea what it was. So the next week I came back and I had a bunch of drawings like this, and I was super excited about this because it's like the sexiest profile I've ever drawn in my life. It's 8 foot high. You've got like flood deposits in here. You've got artifacts in between. And like it's something that's like very easy to unpack. And if you could start dating those flood deposits, you could say, all right, this little sandwich layer of artifacts here is from 1873 or something like that. So exciting stuff. But it was, you know, a picture of dirt. And they're like, well, okay, well, we're going to, you know, keep moving. And then I mentioned that these two things on the two sides are builder's trenches. And the one on the left is butting up against the side of the fermenting vats. And that's where things actually got interesting. It's like everybody kind of stopped and they're like, wait, the fermenting vats are under the ground, right? And so up until then, we had a map, a Sanborn map that showed like fermenting vats, but there was no indication that these things were subterranean. It didn't really make any sense at all. And so that's when we started removing the cap, like where the bulldozer is there. And whenever we first pulled it back, it just kind of dropped away into a void, because what happened was in 1950s or so, Shinley Distillers decommissioned the place. They covered the entire floor in a concrete floor, and everybody just forgot about it. And it settled a little bit over time, and that's where that void came from. So at that point, everything kind of changed. So again, with that slowing down and taking a second look at things, I forget who it was. I think it might have been Meredith. Remembered that there was this book of lithographs that people thought were maybe exaggerations. Freddie Johnson told me that there was one picture in here that they thought was just completely made up. But the more that we started excavating, the more that we started looking at these, we realized that they're fairly accurate. And this is a fairly accurate drawing of that fermenting wing. And in addition to that, we actually had Taylor's words describing what he was thinking. Like in this case, all of the windows, the light coming in, the slate floor, being able to wash off everything between runs was all connected to his idea of sanitation and needing to correct some of the unsanitary conditions that he saw in the industry at that time. He talks about things like fermenting distiller's beer falling through slate floors, acidifying, making the whole area smell horrible. And so what he did was he lined his fermenting vats in copper to where they could be polished to a mirror-like sheen between runs. And because of that, his whiskey, in his words, was the best you could get at the time. So that's all great. And in addition to the pictures and his words, we actually started to find artifacts coming out of this as well. So Shinley Distillers were in such a hurry that you see the kind of axe marks in this area. That's part of the copper sheeting, and they just couldn't get it off that quickly. They were recycling and salvaging the rest of it, but this bit and a few others, they just threw down into that vat. So it's exciting because, at one, you get that kind of connection because you really – these kind of gouge marks you really only see in moonshine sites most of the time when somebody finds a still and they're axing it to make sure it never functions again. But here it's like, all right, somebody's probably frustrated because it wasn't doing what they wanted to and they threw it in there. But when you flip it over, you could see the little channel cut there, and there was long bolts and whatnot, and we could actually figure out how this thing was constructed, how they connected the copper sheeting to those brick vats. So it's a kind of unexpected detail that we didn't, it was a pleasant surprise. And then we took it a step further, and we actually scratched down under the patina, the rust layer on this copper sheeting, and we were able to take a culture of the last yeast that had been in contact with that. So that was awesome, but that was the point where I was like, all right, it became proprietary information, and I don't know what they did with it, but I do know that they took this information and actually reconstructed one of the fermenting vats. And we have all of the information from Taylor's words, from the archaeological information, from the building itself, to where, yes, there wasn't that fume hood or whatever. There's some modern standards that we have to stick to. But for the most part, what Buffalo Trace is doing now is they're starting to recreate this 150-year-old whiskey off of those very authentic elements. It's going to be about 8 years before we can taste it, unfortunately. And I've already tried. You can't really reach in there and actually get your fingers into the fermenting vat. So I don't know. If anybody gets like a fishing pole or something, you might be able to. So anyway, so you guys can this is open. Anybody that actually RSVPs for a tour, they can go and see it. Some other things that aren't really accessible. Another part, this is a lithograph of the outside of that building. But just to the left of it in this picture is a small residential structure. It was called Riverside. Now it's called the E.H. Taylor House, I believe. And it's an example of another one of those feature systems, so where people are living at. And in 2010, I had an opportunity to go and dig, this is while I was still at UK, and I brought some UK students to kind of look at this before they renovated it. Let's see. Just stop talking. All right. And this is what it looked like at the time. So as we started looking at the history of this particular building, in the 1790s, when everything was still known as Leestown over there, the building was a residence, supposedly one of the first buildings built in Franklin County. Then it became a butcher shop, the master distiller's office, a bourbon laboratory. It was eventually just a location of the punch clock, and then it became the unofficial break room because there was, like, Natty Light cans and things like that that were underneath the floorboards. It was the kind of haunted ghost tour, that dentist chair with a strobe light kind of sat in that doorway there behind it. And I think somebody was back like shaking chains or something for the ghost tour part of this. And now it's the historic house museum that interprets E.H. Taylor's connection with Buffalo Trace. And they also have in the top floor a laboratory. That's just, it's just awesome. So here we found a prehistoric site up underneath the floorboards, which is interesting and kind of gives a little bit of authenticity to that idea of Native Americans camping here, waiting for the bison to cross the river on the trace, this namesake, right? But maybe a little bit more interesting, at least to me, was we found a trash pit. That's exciting to me. But it's a rock-lined trash pit that was constantly emptied. And what was going on there is folks are keeping their workplace clean. There's a lot of waste byproduct that goes into industrial distillering. In this case, there were things like coal cinders and Band-Aids and broken decorative hair combs and things like that coming out of here. So that kind of waste disposal, as they would take that and dump it on the back of the distillery property. And we actually see that again pop up in some other places. So to shift tiers a little bit and staying with this idea of waste disposal, we'll come back to it in a second. We have the Jack Jewett site, and we actually found his distillery that he started working on in the 1790s or so. So a few years ago, I think it was maybe 2012, 2013, the director of the Jewett House contacted me. They were running low on membership. They wanted to do something to kind of reinvigorate people's interest in the house site. And they're like, well, we do have something of a distillery associated with Jack, but we have no idea what it is, where it is. We have a few documents to talk about it. Other than that, what they have is the story of Jack Jewett, Revolutionary War hero. He did a ride that was similar to Paul Revere's, but it was longer and more important. He actually saves Thomas Jefferson at one point. He just didn't have as good of a publicist. So this is what they do. The only artifact associated with Jack, unfortunately, is the house itself. So very interested in this because when I started to dig into what they called, oh, we just have a document, it was about 10 years of these legal lawsuit documents. So lawsuits are also good for archaeologists, as well, old ones anyway, are good for archaeologists. And here, there's lots of details because what happened was when Jack started his distillery in the 1790s, he ended up selling it in exchange for 1,400 gallons of whiskey to the Buck family, Peter and Charles Buck. And they were to distill all those gallons and give it to him a year or two later, and they never paid. What they said was he was falsely advertising, like, sure, he had all the components for a distillery, but the creek never ran at all, and you can't make whiskey without some kind of water. At least a little bit at some point of the day. I don't know if it was a drought or if Jack was maybe a liar, but who knows. There's lots of details in this, though, because we could say even though the distillery maybe wasn't as successful as the Bucks wanted it to be or as productive, both they and Jack Jewett were using slave labor in order to do their distilling. We don't actually know the names of the slaves, but we do have ads in the paper where they're offering to sell the best distiller that they have, that they own at the time when Jack is moving to Bath County. We also have other small details, like it was producing between 40 and 60 gallons of whiskey in a day when it actually functioned. And it also adds things like it's at this intersection of the creek and other details like that, enough to where we're actually able to find it. So this is a LIDAR map, a topographic map of the site. And oh, this is dead entirely. On the left side up there, that kind of bold double line, that's the Bluegrass Highway, just between Versailles and Lawrenceburg exits. And then it drops down into the narrows that go down to the Kentucky River. The red arrow is pointing at the mill race that goes through Craig's Creek and redirects water to where it would have ran Jack's grist mill whenever the water was actually running. There's also two foundations down in this area, a lot of different historic roads that crisscross the site. And then back in that area, those squares are livestock pens, because with farm distilleries especially, you see a lot of livestock to where the spent mash is being fed to them and whatnot. There's actually distilling manuals from the early 1800s that say if you have this size of still with this capacity, go on and buy 50 head of hog because you'll have enough offset to be able to support them. So it was very much a part of this until the sanitation aspect came back, and maybe it was actually Taylor's fault that you had to move your livestock away from the distillery. I'm not sure. So some more pictures of it. Whenever we realized that we had the actual site, what we did with the Jewett House was we put a call out in the newspaper and said, if you have any interest in archaeology, whiskey, Jack Jewett, being outside, come and join us. We're going to look for this thing. And we thought maybe a few people would show up. And over the course of a year, 130 people showed up and wanted to dig. And it got a little out of control, but it was fine. It was fine. It was a very stressful time. But as a result, though, we fully defined the site. We didn't actually find a lot of artifacts down where the foundations were. Again, maybe because of that keeping your work area clean idea. We found like a button that had popped off of somebody's pants. And this red dot here at the bottom, we called that the parking lot because we found some like a bridle and a horseshoe down there. But that was really all we found in the southern part of the site. On the northern part of the site, we actually found 1,800 artifacts. So it's very dense up there in that the top where it's kind of reddish and pink. So we ended up investigating that area a little bit more. We ended up putting 2 1x2 units to take a look at that. And in general, the types of things that we're finding were very small artifacts, like the size of your fingernails. It was obviously that it was obvious like waste. It wasn't really burnt, but it had the kind of feel of this is where you're just throwing everything and you kind of let it smolder over time, right? The artifacts date from around the late 1700s through the early 1900s, which is the timeline that we understood the site to actually function. Because the more that we looked at this, an interesting thing that we didn't really expect for a site in the middle of the woods is a little bit of oral history came to us via the landowner. So Paul Stapp, who is 93 or 94 right now, he actually remembered whenever he was a kid talking to a fellow that was born on this site. And that guy was telling stories about hopping into a wagon full of stoneware jugs, full of whiskey, riding it down to the river. And so he's always known this place as a distillery site, but didn't think we could really learn anything more about it. So that was interesting, and the artifacts are interesting. It was a little disappointing that they were all mixed, at least until we opened up one of the 1x2 units. So this picture is a drawing of looking at the wall of one of those units, a 2-meter-long wall. The ruts at the top, those kind of three areas, are four-wheeler ruts from where the area was terraced with those historic roads, and apparently you can get some air if you go fast enough in a four-wheeler. It's a lot of fun, I hear. And then the area down below it was where a lot of that mixing was happening. But where the arrow is pointing there was actually an area of, we call it closed context in archaeology jargon, but basically the only thing that was there were artifacts from the early 1700s. We found butchered bone. We actually have like a pig vertebrae that has little stab marks in it from where somebody was eating the thing and had been cooked. Found a piece of a fork and some other like kind of kitchen related items. So while this thing was operating as a distillery, what we're working in here might have been the location of the break room or at least some sort of like kitchen type area. We also found a lot of other artifacts, including maybe something off of Revolutionary War hero's jacket is kind of what we like to say because of the amount of stars, but who knows, it could have come from almost anywhere. You can see the size of the artifacts there where Anne's washing them. They're all very small, but you find a little bit more things that add like texture to this area that's in the middle of nowhere, right? Because the jaw harp down there in the bottom left, you can imagine that you have the sound of like grain being ground up in the grist mill. Maybe somebody's waiting with the fire crackling and all of that, and they're twanging away on the jaw harp. So it kind of adds some texture to this piece of history. And we literally only found one out of those 1,800 artifacts, one artifact that could be possibly directly connected with distilling, because you could put a lot of other things in stoneware jugs, but this one was a little rough. The picture isn't good enough resolution to tell, but you can actually see like a thumbprint in this area where somebody was hand-making this jug at one point. So to look at the southern part of the site, this is kind of what the building foundations look like. Again, we have that problem of not like no big sign that says distillery or whatever. But the layout of the site is what's actually interesting here. Where the two trees are, they're in the back left of the area. Just behind that is where one of those roads comes by. And it's positioned in a way that if they ground up their grain, they could bring it up here and then use gravity to assist them to dump that grain into the building and start the fermentation, and maybe the distillation happened here as well. About one story worth of limestone block has kind of fallen in on the inside, and it was just a little too much for us to try to move that and see if there was anything below that area. It was also around this time that one of our people, it was actually Janice, the director of the Jewett House, broke her ankle in the creek. So our emergency plan worked out well to get her out of there, but we're a little leery of getting too many people in this area with the really uneven ground. So there's a little bit of danger involved with this as well. That idea of gravity, it wasn't just a fluke here at the Jewett site. A few miles up the Kentucky River, also in Woodford County, was the Epler Distillery, positioned in very much the same way, very steep hill. This is a dam structure they use to control the flow of water and whatnot. But again, the distillery is set up in a way where they make use of that very steep hill. So I don't have topographic lines on this, but the top of the screen is almost straight up and down. You almost have to get on all fours to go up the hill if you're going to go up that way. And the dam was a few hundred feet above where the stream comes in there. And what we have here so far is we have a milling component set up on a very deep area of the creek that looks like it's artificially deepened. You have the actual distillery area, all of it, again, set up in, to make maximum use of the slope of the site. And then you have the household area. So unlike the Jewett site, where all we have is kind of that industrial component, we don't really know where people are living at, even though we know where they were eating. Here you have a mixture of artifacts. The people living in that house were supposed to be John and Boone, Epler, two brothers, and their sister Mary Epler. And whenever they died, the site was just abandoned. They had no children and apparently no family to give it to. So Mary, being the only woman associated with the site, we're finding a lot of evidence of her. There's gendered clothing items, little clasps and things like that that you would find in women's clothing. There's also pieces of jewelry and whatnot as well. So it's interesting starting to unpack her presence there as well, but we're in the middle of analyzing and still doing the work on this site. Let's see. This is a picture of that. Again, we're starting to be able to unpack the difference between just a pile of rocks associated with a historic house site and what actually makes a distillery through this work. But still a little bit more to go here. So one last tier, and we can open it up for any questions at all, is starting to scratch the surface with moonshine a little bit. As I started to do this work, Wayna Adams, who's an archaeologist with Daniel Boone National Forest, just mentioned to me that they have 288, as of last week, moonshine sites that have been documented within the forest property. And they really haven't looked at them at all. They've documented them as disturbance to rock shelters and kind of don't do anything with them because they're afraid of disturbing the prehistoric remains that are underneath those moonshine sites. So they're just kind of sitting there and preserved in place. But we started looking a little closer at some of them. This is not a picture of it because there's really nothing to see at this site. But there was a site documented in 1985 called the Hanging Bucket Site. It was nestled in a rock shelter, and it was a still, a bucket hanging on a little cylinder pole above a fire pit. Lots of lard buckets, little mason jars, things like that. And right next to that whole moonshining area, there was a bed that was made out of just a collection of logs and a whole bunch of leaves. So the fellow was, there was the resident feature system there where the guy's just kind of sleeping next to everything. And there was also the kind of distilling component. For me, that was very interesting because most moonshine sites that you see pictures of or see any kind of detail about are very specialized, just like this. There's no bed in this picture. Really, the only thing that's not really associated with work is the dog there on the left that's trying to get some byproduct or something. I'm not sure what he's up to. But so we're going to start looking at that later on this year. We have a site kind of close to London where the rock shelter has been abandoned and untouched. So you see the barrel rings around these barrels? On that particular site that doesn't have a name yet, the barrel is actually decomposed in place and they fell, and it's just like a concentric ring of barrel rings where they all just kind of fell straight down and they're just sitting there nice and neat. It's that undisturbed, which is kind of unheard of. And we also have a little bit more to pull from by Big South Fork, just to the south. The late Timothy Smith and Tom DeJean did a very detailed study on 150 sites that they had found related to moonshine throughout Big South Fork. Most of them were concentrated in one valley. And they actually found that their moonshine sites they really didn't have anything artifact-wise. They were mostly three stacks of stone, and the reason that they didn't really have artifacts in a lot of them were that people were purposely taking the artifacts with them and scattering them on the way home. They'd throw them down the holler or whatever. So you have like a long valley, a whole lot of garbage down in the very bottom next to the creek and whatnot, and then rock shelters on the high parts of the valley that have stones like that. And they were able to unpack like the signatures of all of that. So Tom is still around, and he's interested in looking at this a little bit closer, but that might be something that maybe I can present on in more detail this time next year. So if you want to get into lots of details about these things, there's a chapter that I published in an edited volume last year that goes into like the model of what makes a distillery versus a historic house site or other types of sites, and kind of lays out the groundwork for more research so other archaeologists can kind of join me. Or if you want just like one-on-one time to go and like tour some of these sites, you can get a hold of Mint Julep Tours or Matson and Gilman, and we schedule things to go and just have a day looking at archaeological sites. It's a whole lot of fun. So thanks for the time, and if you have any questions, I'm here rest of the afternoon. So thank you all. Oh, what's going on in this? Okay, so the so Scott here is streaming, so I'm going to repeat the questions so that thing can hear. So this is the about half-mile walk that we had to do through Craig's Creek. This is a lot of the people with the Jack Jewett Archaeological Project that came and worked with me on figuring out Jack's distillery. And Sue Finney there in the front is a high school teacher with Woodford County. And Thomas, are you in that picture? Yeah, so that you in the purple, and then we had somebody had retired from state government in front of you. And then Rosemary here is my daughter, and I wrote down how tall she was at that time because it didn't have a photo scale. I forget how tall she was, but she was about 3 or 4 in that picture. So I used her to, you know, get scale on things. But, yeah. All right. Other questions at all? Yeah, Craig. Yeah. So I think in general, the whiskey industry has found that people don't really like smoke and mirrors, those type of brands that are just kind of made up. Maybe they don't have an authentic history or something like that. They don't sell as well. So about 20 years ago, Jack Daniel's had published a visitor's guide. And this is how you give a tour of Jack Daniel's distillery. And one of the very first pages of it is, don't let the facts get in the way of a good story. And so it's just like, all right, so what are you getting here, you know? So most of the time when you see people that they go to Buffalo Trace, right? I mean, they're interested in the stories. That's one of the reasons that Freddie Johnson is such a big hit, right? He's got 3 generations involved with that distillery. You got that kind of deep time where he's talking about things that his grandfather did, things that he did as a kid there on the distillery, and people really connect to that. And so when they look at the products that come out of Buffalo Trace, they have that kind of fond memory of it, right? But then you see others as well where you got like Whiskey Row in Louisville, where people are coming, they're looking at the facades, you're immersing yourself in this very real history, and it's not like a Disneyland aspect, right? So it will be interesting to see, looking at these kind of authentic histories and looking at what's going on with the Stoli and the Kentucky Owl brand is coming up right now, because the industry is referring to that as a bourbon wonderland, right? Where you're building something in this rock quarry. I heard at one point there's going to be like a roller coaster or something. I don't know. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with that, because the Kentucky Owl brand, it does have an authentic history, but the place where it's being distilled, maybe not so much. So you see in other things like the documentary Neat, right, where people talk a lot about that it's not the whiskey. It's not like you're sitting down and doing jello shots with your friends, and that's why whiskey bourbon is popular. Instead, they talk about the stories that are in the bottle. So you talk about the things where maybe you met Jimmy Russell one day, and you talk about that when you're having like a bottle of Wild Turkey or something, right? So I think those elements, while not super specific, I mean, it gives you a feeling of the value of the authenticity to this industry. You want me to go in more detail anywhere? So, all right. Yeah. Right. So I think one of the very basic things to do, well, I mean, obviously you don't want to dig it up. You just kind of leave it in place. But I think making some sort of map of what you see, what you know of, right? Because whenever I was super excited about the Jewett distillery, I was like, oh, we found this thing. We've tracked down the landowners and went in there. I was like, I found a distillery. It's on your property. It's so exciting. And they're like, oh, yeah, we know about that. It was just like, so, you know, so I think getting a map showing like where this is on your property, any stories that you have associated with it, because some of it, you know, I mean, there are accidents or folks are getting older and people might forget specific stories, or they might forget details that go with stories. And I think starting to document some of that. But then if there's a lot there, I think definitely reaching out like through Facebook to the Bourbon Archaeology page or to your page in Kentucky Unearthed to get some tips of like, all right, what do I do with this? Can I have somebody come out and look at it? Depending on where people are in the state, sometimes it's a very easy like – I could tell Tiffany, oh, we're going to the zoo and we're going to take a shortcut and, oh, look where we are, you know. And some we've gone to a few sites that way. Or, you know, if there's very specific places with people that have a lot of history and just need some pointers, we can definitely go out that way as well. Other questions at all? All right. Well, I'm here for a while if you want to talk one-on-one afterward, too. Thank you all very much for your time.
Guys, thank you again for being here today. Please stop and chat with Nick on your way out. I forgot to tell you before we started, if you enjoyed the music that was playing when you came in, that was Brett Ratliff, who is a wonderful Appalachian musician and community activist. And he's going to be with us next Friday evening for our History Cafe event, playing a concert, hopefully in the garden, if the weather cooperates. If not, we'll be in here. But he's fantastic. I'll put his music back on. Sure hope to see you next Friday as well. Thank you, guys. Have a great day.